Welcome to Naked Word Radio. I'm part the fourth of the curious chronicle of the lost heart, in which a man with a heart is full of ideas, and a man with no heart would take them away. And there are times when you just can't let the sleeping dog lie. Sleeping with the enemy, an end to trust. In the father's recording booth of the music room are two or three brothers. I did for a while teach all three, but the oldest decided to disagree with a screw and ended up in solitary. They are inside for dealing their own kind of justice to their mother's boyfriend, who decided to abuse her. The two remaining write a mix of rap and melody, both very talented men. Their lyrics, predictably anti-authority and pro-heterosex, leave little to the imagination and sometimes give me some interesting explaining to give to my superiors. The college, who employ me to teach in the prison, wants to take away the creative side of learning music, whether it be playing an instrument or writing and recording. Their argument is that these things are difficult to quantify physically and therefore justify financially. They are, of course, not wrong, but I have to argue that the benefits of music cannot be simply contained to a mechanical process. The college would like me to teach scales and keys, clefs and staves, how to construct a chord and how to read the dots, as they are commonly called. Anything theoretical, in fact, that requires no practical or physical expression of music. But a language has to be used for it to have any point. And the point of music is its ability to express emotion and reach into our hearts. I know that the battle to teach the men the gift of music is one I will eventually lose. But in the meantime, the men and I will do our best. Yes, you can set tests and evaluate a person's understanding of the theory, but to what end and for what point? In the booth next to the brother rappers is a middle-aged man, mild and modest, an unlikely candidate for a stretch inside, I had thought at first sight. However, he had returned home early one day to find his wife and best friend in bed together. Not a man who understood fighting or violence in any way, he had somehow, in his fury, managed to break the fellow's arm. He is learning folk songs and the guitar and can hesitantly sing his way through quite a few. He lost his council flat because of the incident, but not his true friends. His release is impending, and whenever he gets a letter from his new lady love, he reads it to me. In one, she describes the new duvet set she has bought and how she is looking forward to sharing it with him. There's a crack in his voice, and I'm not entirely sure I want to hear this, but it's obviously important for him. There are a wide range of offenders attending my class. One, a very good classical musician who had murdered his father, plays both the piano and violin, but his chances of being allowed a violin whilst inside are extremely unlikely. He is a lifer, and given the fact that he refuses to admit his guilt, he will find it hard to get parole, and without parole he might never play the violin again. There are Asians, busted for filling suburban houses with marijuana plants. There's a man learning 60 songs on guitar, doing 5 years for embezzling a sum of money that a politician will get a few months in an open prison for. One student, a vegan who made a fortune manufacturing illegal pharmaceuticals, is remembering his childhood piano lessons. And a man who claimed to be banned from every casino in the UK because he was so good at winning is trying to write love songs. Not 5 feet away from him sits a man at a desk recording on a computer, headphones clamped on his shaved head. Once again, I am impressed how music helps the men focus their concentration and blank out anything that could be a distraction. There was also an arsonist who clearly should be in an institution that can care for him, a drug smuggler still fighting HMRC for his money, and a host of petty criminals whose position in society more or less guaranteed several returns as guests of Her Majesty. Having done my rounds, I return to Tom and find him strumming his lonely chord. "Teach me another, come on," says Tom, standing up suddenly and knocking the guitar accidentally against the table. He hardly noticed, but I had to remind him that our few guitars were a precious commodity and that there was no way to replace them. He is most apologetic, but his enthusiasm is naturally greater than his care. Over the weeks, I discover that Tom, when he's out, lives mostly on the street, mixing casual work of a dubious nature with opportunistic thieving to fill his belly, feed his occasional habit, and support his friends. He is chaotically charismatic, having a wonderfully simplistic but healthy view of life, philosophical about its ups and downs, and seemingly careless of the fact that he has no skills to help himself get out of the cycle he is trapped in. In music lessons, he is a quick learner and soon has a library of chords that enable him to tackle his favourite songs. What he lacks in accuracy, he easily makes up for in performance, and I find myself believing he could busk on the streets and earn a few straight shillings. His day of release comes and we all wish him well, placing friendly bets on how soon we'll see him again. Sure enough, the day comes up when Tom does reappear. Angling in through the door, he greets me and sits down with a guitar, having dug out some songbooks. He's very excited to tell me that while he was out, he had been busking and was doing very well, until he spotted a lonely wallet on a windowsill, but didn't spot its nearby owner. He's really chuffed that in guitar playing, at least, he has a skill that he can use that he's proud of. His playing and singing has improved, and I can see him as a good busker, with the kind of energy that is magnetic, drawing people and their coins and notes. Suddenly, he stands up, banging the guitar, of course, and brings something out of his pocket. Sitting down again, he proudly unwraps a piece of hash and tries to hand it to me. "This is for you, boss. It's a thank you for teaching me. Come on, take it." Trust is a fragile but essential commodity. I could expect those who don't share my point of view to disagree with me, but not necessarily to distrust me. I could expect that for as long as I was not considered a threat, I'd be left to get on with my work. I found that I had the trust of the men, and largely the warders and governors, at least to begin with. At some invisible point, I became the face of something untrustworthy, and therefore became an enemy to a particular but powerful few. I was slow to recognise this subtle change, and discerning my enemy whilst working in hostile territory was not as simple as I might have thought. I had, in fact, hoped to have no enemies, but life is never so obliging. I'm remembering this incident, sat in my room on that pale watercolour wash day, rolling a one skinner to take round the garden. I'm remembering Tom's struggle with why I couldn't take his well-meaning gift, how he shouldn't even be showing it to me, and I'm remembering, most of all, that incredible trust that he had for me. There are tears in my eyes, not only for this memory, but also because I am experiencing feelings, genuine feelings. I spent so much of life hiding from them, and why? So that I don't suffer emotionally when they don't work out. Working in the prison, I hid from my emotions by instinctively trying to follow a narrow and sometimes almost invisible trail, marrying the musical and creative needs of the men with the exactitudes of the system. I needed the screws and the governors and the college and the men to trust me, despite the differing expectations. In the end, the governors trusted me to be working against them. The screws had no choice but to agree. Looking up at the sky as a cloud covers the sun, I realise I am most proud of the trust the men had in me, and I blow a couple of fragrant smoke rings in the shelter of the apple trees. I have days or weeks, and eventually months, to ponder all these things. Whether striding in the rain, leaning into the wind, sitting in the sun, playing the piano, or cooking a supper. Depression is a wily beast, being both hunter and hunted. I seek it in the deep waters of my solitude, see it sneakily playing in the shoreline waves of my despair. It tracks me down on the high hills that have a view beyond the normal horizons. It trails me as I fly up above the clouds in the clear light of the sun. There are times when I wish to sit down and make a deal with it, negotiate a truce, find some useful harmony to be used creatively. Poems, songs, prose and pictures. But I somehow lose heart at a critical point. Find myself overwhelmed by the impossibility of everything and anything. Depression gives no quarter. It's up to me to take my life back in my own hands. There are mornings where I'm convinced it's purely a chemical thing, and I duly report to the doctors to get a prescription. In our brains, we have synapses that release serotonin, a feel-good hormone. However, some synapses turn greedy and reabsorb the serotonin, depriving our cerebral fluid of the benefits. I took them for a few months, but gave them up as soon as I felt my self-confidence reappear. I was learning to trust again, and, most importantly, myself. The last concert I had organized involved the men commonly known as VPs, vulnerable prisoners, segregated from normal daily prison life. On the afternoon of the concert, the men and I set up the PA system borrowed from the chapel. Warders stand around, having to look busy and alert as the room fills with a variety of governors, social workers, and a collection of luminaries from the custodial world. Many have come to evaluate the worth of such activities, some just to listen. Civilian canteen workers wheel in trolleys of tea and cake. I do my rounds and check that the men performing are all okay. They have chosen the running order and organized all the details, including the MC. I give the nod, move to the back of the room, and the concert hesitantly begins. It has its highs and lows, genuine laughter at humor well delivered, and almost embarrassment as a con gets it wrong. Overall, though, there is overwhelming support from the men and all the visitors. At the end, it is considered a great success, and the men and I received many congratulations. At the time, I never saw or felt this concert as anything other than part of a process of enjoyment and empowerment for all the men concerned. Two ladies from the Independent Monitoring Board, a nationwide voluntary organisation available for prisoners, make a beeline for me as I am thanking the governor for allowing the concert to happen. They greet him effusively, snaring him into further conversation as one of the men addresses me quite loudly and directly. It's so good for the men to be given all this responsibility, and who would guess that they should have such talent? The other lady, her hair swept up and robust if rumpled tweed suit, urges the governor to agree. You must notice an improvement in discipline and behaviour after events like these. The governor suddenly appears like a man who would much rather be back out on the golf course, and I sense him looking for a conversational exit. These women are not to be deterred, however, in their relentless pursuit of fairness. Concerts like this should happen on a regular basis, show off the men's talents and remind them of their independence. My heart begins to sink, and the very beginnings of a bad feeling creep up my spine. These two well-meaning ladies are stroking the governor's fur the wrong way, and I try to rescue the situation. Come and talk to the pianist. He'd appreciate your comments before the men are all escorted back to their wing, I say to them both, urging them with an outstretched arm to step with me. But I can no longer trust where to put my feet or where my new enemies might be hiding. And here ends part the fourth of the Curious Chronicles of the Lost Hut.